This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Initially, what I thought I was going to ask you about was about sort of like who has access to the future, but then I feel like you like did that really well. Like you addressed that really well. And so then the thing that I got kind of fixated on while I was listening to you was sort of about the idea of the event, which was something that that is like there's a few little moments where it's literally spoken in the video, but where there's sort of an idea that like a time capsule is an event, but that it also marks an event. And so I guess I was just kind of curious, what your, you know, sort of, if you have anything else to say about how that kind of relates to your own interest as far as, what events mean both as ways that we sort of reflect on history. So when I think about like my life, or I think about the way that history is told, it tends to be told through the history of events, right? So like a historical event is a revolution, right? You know, but there's like events that make up a revolution that kind of make it like push into revolutionary sort of status versus like just being like a rowdy day, you know? And so, you know, and so I'm kind of thinking about like, what is that sort of like, you know, conception of events, of sort of the accumulation of events over time, and how they then, you know, sort of mark time, but then also the very premise of doing something like time capsule as an event in and of itself.
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting question or thought that takes me down a different line. But yeah, I mean, well, when you look at the word event, what does event mean? It means happening. It just straight up means happening. So anything is a anything is a happening. And so I think it goes back to the notion of access and privilege, like whose events, whose happenings get to be told, whose happenings get recorded, whose happenings, you know, get privileged as the official narrative of a thing or of an event. And so, you know, frequently or historically, only certain people have had privilege of having their happenings be recorded as history or as a historical event. And there's this whole, there's a book called Culture and Memory in African American Tradition that talks a lot about this and talks a lot about just so many events happening in sort of African culture or African American communities that just challenge the notion of memory and history, because you don't hear, you don't know about them, but there's these stories that pass down orally, or there's the, you know, you find your grandmother's letter to her uncle or whatever, but again, it's not privileged as history. So our conception of history and of historical events is extremely narrow in ways that we don't realize, and is not expansive at all, because who, again, this notion of what an event is privileged by who gets access or whose story gets to be told. So that's what that makes me think of. And yeah, I thought it was really interesting in the video, one of the people said, you know, on the notion of whether the letter actually even existed, but that he was just using the time capsule as a mechanism to talk about what he wanted to talk about. And I just thought that was the most interesting thing. So I was gonna ask you about that, or what you thought about, you know, whether or not this letter even existed, just, you know, the notion of or the abstract notion of that being used as a mechanism.
Right. I mean, so to say a little bit about that, when I started working on the project, it was, I was fairly sure that the letter had never been written. Because I had interviewed, prior to working on this project, I was working on another project, and it was interviewing some like right-wing historians. Leftist historians of the right wing and right-wing historians of themselves. So, you know, from different sides, but all kind of focusing on that history. And from numerous sides, I kind of brought up this idea of the time capsule, and people were like, oh, no, Reagan, he made shit like that up all the time. Like, they were like, he just was like, you know, this, like, it was just this rhetorical device to conjure an image of the future in people's heads. And it's like this brilliant, device, like what a great idea for how to stand up in front of a group of people that are, you know, sort of like, you know, from all different parts of the country and have different life experiences, but get them all to sort of like think about 100 years in the future.
Right.
And in a way, I kind of got fixated on that part. Like when you actually like listen to him talk in the speech, he's describing this kind of weird like creative writing problem where he's like, how do I write a letter to the people in the future? They already know me, but I don't know them. And it's like, and I just thought like, this is a very strange thing to be sort of describing in public, like your like inability to creatively write something. And so I just sort of thought like, okay, I'm just interested in Reagan's sci-fi imagination. And I don't really care whether the letter existed. And I just assumed that this whole project that I was gonna work on was gonna sort of be about what might have been written on that letter.
Right.
And like how that as a jumping off point for just exploring his imagination. And then the implications for that imagination on our lives. Like, how are we maybe living in Ronald Reagan's sci-fi imagination?
Yeah.
And so from that point, yeah, I was like totally, you know, it was not going to be like documentary or documentary-esque. And it was really just kind of like an more open-ended research project. And then I just sort of like through, you know, actually doing the research, I just actually figured out that it probably did exist and it probably was in that time capsule at the Griffith Observatory in LA, but that was not what I was like specifically yeah. interested in. And so it ended up sort of having some of this kind of documentary, you know, kind of, element to it. But yeah, the whole premise in a way was sort of like, who cares if it exists? Actually, that's sort of the point of like a time capsule anyway. It's like, well, you're not gonna see it.
Right.
It's not really for you. Isn't it interesting that maybe like he just made shit like that up all the time?
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, but even the notion that it's not for you, but what people end up putting into it is intensely personal and
totally,
intensely
totally.
Like
yeah.
shit that other people don't care about,
yeah.
but that you care
yeah.
about, you know, so, even though it's not for you. So yeah. it's just interesting.
Yeah. yeah.
And then the juxtaposition of that with the school and their time capsule project, I was wondering about your motivation for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it was just sort of something that developed in the same town that I was like, kind of doing some of the other research. And it just seemed like, well, okay, it would be really interesting to document one that's unfolding. And then as I, you know, just like, I wasn't really quite sure how to integrate it. You know, I was just kind of going to their meetings and documenting their meetings and wasn't quite sure where it was going to end up. And then it became clear that that their relationship, that a lot of the young people's relationship to time was really quite different, and that that was something that was really important to kind of bring into the project.
So, right. Yeah. Exactly.
So maybe we have time for like to take a couple of like comments or questions, and then we can wrap up or eat some more snacks together. Does anyone have anything? If not, we can just eat snacks right away.
I have a question.
Okay.
And I'm holding the mic, so.
Okay.
I took some notes, so I'm just gonna read it, if that's all right. I was thinking about how linear concepts of time are embedded with power, specifically how Reagan was using that as a way to promote his sort of like neoliberal agenda, right? His concept of futurity was sort of like the continuation or propelling the US forward. But linear concepts of time are, for colonized people or people of color, it's actually a narrative of erasure. And so I was thinking in terms of like Rashida's work, how the practice of futurity is a way for colonized peoples to not only imagine and exist in a decolonial future, but also for a way to remember. And as a way to actively do the work of filling those hollows of time and sewing that fabric of time back together. So not only existing in the future, but also remembering a past that's been erased.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly that. That notion of remembering a past that's been erased is exactly the point of, you know, in terms of what I was talking about in African notions of time, it automatically returning back to the past, how important that deep past is for all of us. And I think that's exactly right, that the political and the temporal have always been connected in that way. Even Obama, you know, used that same narrative of forward progress. His campaign slogan of change implicates time, and his 2012 campaign slogan was forward. You know, it's that same thing. But you know, as we know, people without political power are confined to these very narrow temporal bands. They're not allowed to sort of plan for their future in the same way that people with wealth, access, ability, you know, other abilities have to. So it is very important to think about futurities in terms of how they differ for people on the margins of society, people who have intersecting identities, who are not just white males, who, again, you know, are privileged with that linear time that is being imposed on, you know, sort of reality and the world. Mm-hmm. So just my thought. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, the only thing I'll say, you know, in sort of watching all these Reagan speeches, that really struck me was the kind of just the sheer confidence that he's, you know, speaks from. And what that's, and I mean, I think that's very much related, right? You know, is just like, what does it mean to be confident that your vision of the future will in fact become mm-hmm. the future? And how that differs from a more ethical kind of position that is often more characteristic of people who care for other human beings, like, which are, you know, lots of different kinds of people, right? Including like leftists and mothers and women and, you know, all sorts of people who care about other people. And so that ethical position right. oftentimes means that like you have to consider a lot of different variables when you're thinking about like possible futures. And that like, but when you're Ronald Reagan, you actually don't have to consider so many variables. You pretty much have like proximity to power. You have no ethical position to negotiate. And so you're just like, you know, stoked that your vision of the future is going to be real.
Yeah. And the concept of like, again, going back to this concept of the time capsule of like this position from the present of, oh, what do people in the future want to know about me versus how are my actions in the present affecting people in the future? Like, what, you know, exactly what you said, that ethical or that empathetic position of how are my present actions going to affect the future, not just am I going to survive into the future or what information of mine is, or is my legacy going to survive into the future? Thinking about impact, thinking about, you know, all of that stuff, I think is necessary.
Okay, and just before there's a question, I just also wanted to acknowledge that the editor on this project is in the room, Valerie Keller. Can you raise your hand, Valerie?
So, ow!
So thanks so much to Valerie for really working with me very deeply on this project. It was a great experience to work with you. So also, if people want to chat with Valerie about the project. But there's a question? Okay.
Well, first, thank you both, Rashida and Daniel, for this fantastic pairing, and look hopefully forward to more dialogue between you and around your works. I'm struck by this from the final slide, this notion of the tools of time travel and the notion that they're right in front of us, they're accessible. And in both of the film and the workshop, this idea that there are tools of history around us, as well as the idea that the project of history has somehow failed us, mm-hmm. whether historians or archives or time capsules. And we have these visions of people taking history into their own hands. So I'm just curious how you see your work of taking history into your own hands, respectively, in relationship to the the notion of the traditional historian or the traditional archive, is there any possibility of crossover, or is this a matter of having to push back against that kind of enterprise or project?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for the question, Paul. One thing that just sort of struck me that relates to what I was talking about earlier in terms of the narrative of just like even starting on this project is that I think that this like may not really be related to your question, but my past experience is much more like in sort of documenting the work of social movements that I am sort of like sympathetic to in a way. So as a historian, quote unquote, which I'm not trained to be, so I probably, you know, shouldn't say I am, but whatever. As somebody who sort of works on projects about writing history, I have often had a kind of complicated relationship to the stuff that I'm documenting where I more or less agree with it, but it's kind of hard to get into the fact that, like, into the nuances of the stuff that I don't agree with. So if I'm sort of like, yeah, I really want this thing to exist in the world, this, like, you know, community organizing history that nobody knows about, I really want people to know about this. And so I'm maybe not going to spend a ton of energy trying to also tell you about why it failed and why it was, like, really terrible and who, you know, what the internal conflicts were and stuff like that, because I more or less agree with it, and so I want it to be in the world. And then there was, like, sort of a shift over time in my own work, just as, like, somebody that makes these kinds of documents, where I started to realize that that was totally boring to me. That I wasn't like learning anything by making documents about things that I vaguely agreed with but had a difficult time kind of having a critical relationship to. And so that in order to kind of figure out my critical relationship to these kinds of sort of social movement histories, that I needed to take up writing histories that were more about things that I disagreed with explicitly as a way to figure out, even just to develop that capacity in myself to sort of be more critical, but also to understand these things that also a lot of the people that I, you know, kind of collaborated with were sort of just like allergic to, you know, that people were just like allergic to like anything that had to do with Ronald Reagan or the right wing, and that like all these, you know, kind of like leftist artists that I, you know, did projects with were pretty much like, ugh, I could never like sit around, you know, like listening to that stuff. And I just sort of felt like, well, that's kind of a problem, because actually there's these people run the world, and so it would be helpful if you could like somehow constructively engage with, you know, writing those histories and complicating those histories, and that maybe I, just as somebody who was concerned with history, needed to sort of divert my attention there. So I don't know if it really answers your question, but it's some thoughts on history. So
yeah, for me, a great question. I think that is the work of Afrofuturism, and I think that's part of the work, because what it does is it binds those different temporal stages. So it binds the future, it binds the past, it binds them to the present, so that you can more actively explore these things. And so it implicates history in that sense. And I think another way that it implicates history is, again, you can't just, it's not just about like studying these things or studying these objects. It really does take a paradigm shift. It really does. It's not just about writing it. It's not just about observing. You really have to shift the paradigm. And so part of that, again, is exploring these other alternative ways of engaging with space-time that we all have to engage with, and thinking about how different ways to look at it. So, for example, in African, you know, to go back to African traditions of space and time, they look at things as being imbued with spirit. So an object, you know, an object is not just an object. An object is not just a static historical thing that once its utility is over. Once you're done using that object, it then is nothing no more. It's just a static thing that goes into a museum. And for, you know, forever, we have not had access to these objects because they have been in museums and because they have been collected. So I think like a black quantum futurism or a more Afrofuturistic way of engaging with a historical object would be to say that that object has memory. That object has a perspective. That object is imbued with a spirit because that's how my ancestors saw it, and I can reconcile that with quantum physics, say, and reconcile that with a modern look at reality. I think that's what Afrofuturism allows me to do, or allows people to do. So yeah, it is taking on history in this very different way, or like attempting to shift the paradigm of what that means in this very real way and in concrete practical ways, if that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. So thank you for coming. Please enjoy some snacks on your way out, and please buy some books from Rashida, and please keep in touch.
Yes.
Thanks for coming.